Hey everyone, welcome to the Real Evidence Podcast, where we talk about the digital evidence landscape and how people, processes, and technology unite towards restorative justice. My name is Myron.
And I'm Ashley. And today we have Megan Peterson on the podcast today. Megan is a former forensic interviewer and currently works as the Senior Outreach Specialist for Verify. Thanks for chatting with us today, Megan.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we wanted to have Megan on the show today to talk through her experience as a forensic interviewer and hear her perspective on how forensic interviewers specifically should prepare for court. Megan has a ton of experience in that area, so it'd be nice to talk through that with her. But Megan, before we get to that, we'd love to hear just a little bit about your general experience as an interviewer. So if you want to give us a little background, that'd be cool.
For sure. I'm sometimes an oversharer, and so I'll try to be concise today while we're talking. Also, I've just shared that I feel nervous in this podcast like I do when I'm about to testify, so I feel like it's even appropriate.
It's very fitting.
I kind of fell into forensic interviewing unbeknownst to my plan in life. I went to school to be a CPS investigator. I wanted to always work for Child Protective Services. I didn't even truly know that until I walked into the School of Social Work in college and was like, this is exactly what I want to do. So I had all my hopes and dreams to go into people's homes and help make sure kids are safe. And that snowballed into an opportunity in my county that I was working in as an investigator to be a forensic interviewer. So I left the field, went into interviewing, and was only an interviewer for a year. And I was like, I really miss the field. I think I'm going to go back. So I did. And then after a while, there was another opportunity in another county to be an interviewer with some people that I had a professional relationship with and thought that may be a great team to work for. And so I went back to interviewing, and truly, as much as I love the field and going into people's homes and being that direct line of investigations, talking to the kids is the best part of a whole investigation, in my opinion. And so when I'm presented the opportunity to just talk to kids all day and no longer have to deal with parents or adults, I was like, sign me up. So that's how I became an interviewer.
That sounds really cool. It makes me kind of curious because it sounds like you had that desire like coming out of high school then, or like where was that born? I guess like what made you at an early age, or at what point were you like, I want to do that? Like,
yeah.
You know, again, with CPS and getting into that.
Yeah. I think it was really just, I was heavily involved in church camp as a kid. I went every single summer. I went to several different church camps every summer. And at the age that I was able to be a counselor, I was. And there was a specific camp that I counseled at. And it was for children in a lower socioeconomic status. And it was just kind of eye-opening. I come from a very middle-class family. And I had a really good childhood. And I didn't know about CPS as a kid. I didn't really know that that was a need or that was a service. I had no idea what a child advocacy center was growing up. But then when I had a little bit of exposure to it, I was like, well, if I get to do church camp things and interact with kids and do a positive influence. And so when I left for school, they were like, that you should go in, because I had no major. I didn't know what I wanted to be. I just knew that I wanted to do something good. And so I was undeclared for a very long time. And then finally, it was my college counselor who said, you need to go into social work. And I'm like, oh, that is what I need.
Yeah, it makes total sense.
Yeah. So it just kind of perfectly aligned.
Yeah, I love what you said about when you first started out, you were kind of pulled into one direction and kept getting pulled back into forensic interviewing. And hearing how you talk about it now and how much passion and care you have for that field now, it's interesting to that even despite maybe not knowing at the time, that's really what you were always pulled back to.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, with any job, regardless of what it is, your team, your coworkers, your leadership makes such a huge impact. And I just had an opportunity in even all my jobs to just have a great working environment. And so it just, you know, even though I may have left one county or left one state, it just, you know, I've always had such a really good team to kind of build me up and help me, I don't know, develop my skills and do better and think outside of the box. Because I had no desire to be an interviewer. And in fact, when I first started interviewing, our entire county didn't have the Child Advocacy Center doing the forensic interviews. I did those forensic interviews as a CPS investigator. And so there wasn't that division. And so I was like, I don't really want to just do this piece. But then, of course, that became the best part. So,
yeah. So tell us a little about that. I'm kind of curious. So starting in the CPS doing interviews, we talked about how you got into it, but like how long were you in that space as a CPS doing, as a CPS worker doing interviews? And then what did it look like as you evolved? And like, help our audience understand too, just the amount of years that you've been doing that as well.
Sure. So I started as a CPS investigator in Oklahoma, right out of college. I got hired immediately after graduation. And at that time, I wasn't doing forensic interviews and the investigation, but it was pretty close. It just, I wasn't trained. I asked way too many questions in that moment. I mean, inappropriately so. And then when I moved to Texas, that county that I worked for, we did both. And that was just the way that it was. That's how it had always been. And, you know, forensic interviewing, that world is forever evolving. It's your best practices changing and improving, and it's just getting better and better and better. And at that time, those were starting to learn, like, you shouldn't have someone doing an investigation also doing this piece of the investigation that needs to be held separate and needs to be defended differently and needs to have different training. And so that's kind of what caused that split in our county. So I think that, again, it just was one of those opportunities where I had had this forensic interviewing training and investigative training. And then they were saying, well, you do well enough in the forensic interviewing piece, come over and just do that and help build this team. So when I was, 28, 27, and I just was so flattered that a DA's office was saying, come be a part of this team, even though they weren't the head of our team. That's kind of how they structured it. I was like, absolutely. So I started in social work. I started as a CPS investigator in 2004 and then left CAC World in 22. So almost 20 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And then what is your role now? And then how do you kind of like, I know you well enough to know, like, you're still really active in that space. So, and highly passionate about it. So what is your role now, if you want to give a high level there? And then like, how are you also staying involved, whether it's trainings or different things like that?
Yeah, sort of for sure. World? I think, I really, I tell this story very openly. I really was not looking to leave the CAC. I loved the center I worked with. I loved my team. I loved everything about my job. But I was in a space personally where I just needed to step away from the room for a while. I needed to not be on call every few weeks. I needed to not work an hour away from my home. So I stepped back and I was approached by my current boss with Guardify and said, hey, there's this position open. Would you consider it? And I said, no, that sounds terrible. And she's like, just think you need to step away. You still get to talk to all of your people. You still get to do good. And I was like, I'll think about it. But then that thinking was really quick. And so it just was a good opportunity for me to work from home and to do something a little bit different. So, I proudly say I am not a salesperson. I'm a former forensic interviewer. So please, that should be my title. I wish it was my signature on my email.
I love it. Awesome. So maybe this leads us into sort of the next thing. So we, you know, at the onset of this, by the way, in episode one, Ashley and I talked a little bit about what led us into Guardify and sort of like our story and narrative. And then we heard Ben, our CEO, also talk about that. So it's really awesome to hear a little bit about your transition into that as well. But much of our audience, you know, one of the things we were just talking about coming into this podcast was, does everybody really have the same definition for forensic interviews for that space? And so I think it'd be good for us just to sit into this topic a little bit. Maybe we can start off, Megan, because of the extensive experience that you have in this, how should our audience be thinking about what is a forensic interviewer? What do they do? What's like some of the key terms and just terminology that should be known in this space? You want to enlighten us there a little bit?
Yeah, for sure. It's funny that you asked me that, because when I started testifying, that's the first question you get asked is, what is a forensic interviewer and what is a forensic interview? And that can be a hard thing to concisely share with someone. I can ramble clearly about interviewing all day long, but I needed like that soundbite to be able to say on the stand, that a jury would understand, someone who hasn't ever heard of a forensic interview or interviewer, and how that's different than what you would see on TV with a police officer in an interrogation room, because people think about what they've been exposed to. No one's been exposed to a forensic interviewer on TV. Olivia Benson in Law & Order SVU is not a forensic interviewer. I've shared that before in trainings. I will hold up a picture of Olivia Benson and say, please do not be her, because that is not your role. But I think, and I'll tell you my concise testifying type answer. So a forensic interviewer is a trained, neutral, objective professional who has a conversation with a child at the request of law enforcement and or child protective services to discuss allegations of abuse and or neglect. That's my sentence. And then for a forensic interview, that is a developmentally sensitive, legally sound, structured conversation with a child in an effort to elicit detailed information about an event that the child may have experienced and or witnessed. Those are my definitions on my flashcards right about here. Flashcards.
I like it.
Everyone makes fun of my flashcards, but I made them because it helped me testify better. And then everybody wanted to see them and borrow them. So
are you allowed to take those in when you're like, did you actually have them with you when you're testifying?
Not on the stand.
Okay.
But this is Megan outside of the courtroom. Like just steady breath. I guess those who are listening can't see me narrating, looking at flashcards, but they're very well loved, because I use them all the time. Even before this podcast, I'm like, now what do I say again? Help me remember. So, yeah.
Well, Ashley, one of the main topic that we wanted to cover today was really how should a forensic interviewer prepare for court? And so Ashley, maybe you can tee this up a little bit for us and we can go from there.
Yeah, so one of the big inspirations for having Megan on was what we talked about previously, where you mentioned that there isn't a universal training process for preparing for court. Forensic interviewers are not given the tools or the preparation to go on the stand. So with your experience and what you have done firsthand, what does kind of that look like for you? What is like what has been your experience in court prep?
It's funny because when I first put together even just that testifying presentation, I was voluntold to do it. And it was, you're going to present a webinar. And I was like, oh, okay, great. And that was really overwhelming. It also felt very intimidating because I'm not a presenter. And there, within the child abuse field, there are very well-known presenters and leaders in this field. So I am not a Victor Veith. I am not a Julie Kinnison. An interviewer, Megan Peterson, that worked in Texas. Like that just felt weird to be in that same space. But I have attended some really, really great testifying trainings. I mean, I really have. I have just a notebook full of just notes and slides and PowerPoints and just everything that I could retain. So I've been through a lot of great trainings, but what I was missing was someone giving me those definitions that I put on a flashcard. I was missing someone saying, When you're asked to explain process of disclosure, here's how you can explain it. There's a ton of research about process of disclosure, and you're going to be asked it as an expert on the stand. So I can regurgitate what I read in an article, but I wanted not just the definition and the stages of that process, but then even some real life examples. People learn well from an example. When I'm explaining a foreign concept to you and then helping you relate it to a real life scenario, it makes so much more sense, especially when you're talking about a subject as complex as child abuse, and not just as complex as child abuse, but as in the process that children go through in disclosing abuse, because it's like nothing anybody understands. And people think children should react a certain way and say things in a certain time frame and have outward signs to indicate that they've experienced an abusive situation. And that's just not always the case. And so if in an interview, a child doesn't display verbally, non-verbally, vocally, non-vocally about what it was that happened to them, then it's hard for someone to accept that they're being honest or they're really relaying their account of events. So I just put together something that I had wished I had had as a brand new interviewer, and not something that I came up with after almost 20 years in the field, you know? So I was like, this would be a good thing to have if I was a brand new interviewer. I also, you know, I shared that I started at one county in Texas and then moved to a separate county. I wasn't even tracking the times that I testified when I first started. No one had told me that that would be a good idea. And then there were times when I've been asked on the stand to say how many times I've been qualified as an expert, or how many times I've testified in a criminal courtroom or even in a civil courtroom. And I was like, a lot? Well, that doesn't sound professional. A few. Yeah. So even like those little tidbits, I was like, oh, I wish someone had told me that I should chart this. I had no idea that that would have been important down the road. So that's how I kind of came up with, here's what I would want on a silver platter if I had my wish list.
Out of all of that, so I think one of the things that's curious in my head is like, you know, you rattled off, you kind of went through like a number of things there. Is there like a top three things that maybe you can boil up for the audience just in terms of like, how should they prepare for court? Or like, you know, maybe it is those things you mentioned, but is there any like priority top things as you think through that you would say, like, if you're talking to yourself in the past or to the new forensic interviewer, hey, here's three things for you to consider. What are those?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So I think initially is documentation. So when I think of documentation, I think of every interviewer should have a CV that lists out all of their work history, that lists out all of their training. And what's interesting about a CV that I learned versus a resume, because I didn't know the difference, was that a CV is listing, I mean, a CV can be like a novel, because I am listing every single training I have ever participated in. The title of that training, the date. So if it was a week-long training, if it was just an hour webinar that I participated in, whatever it was. And so I learned to list out every single training that was pertinent to the field. And then oftentimes, because child abuse in that field, your role can be so varied. Some people are interviewers and advocates. Some people are, you know, they do the SANE exam and the forensic or what have you. Sometimes they're dual roles, that I would even section out. Here's the training I got with general child abuse material. And this was a topic for general child abuse things, dynamics, just even child development, those kinds of things. And then here, over this list is everything that's pertinent to forensic interviewing. So I know I've successfully completed X amount of hours in child abuse and X amount of hours in forensic interviewing. So I would divide those two. So having your CV, having your training log, those being two different living documents, and being able to total it by hours completed. Because I couldn't imagine sitting on the stand and saying, I've done these 35 different trainings in the past 2 years. So I collect that by hours. I think it's a more succinct way of presenting your experience and your training. And then keeping a log of every single forensic interview you've ever done. You don't have to necessarily say the child's name, the age, the allegation, but just that I did this interview. I know to the number how many forensic interviews I've conducted in my life, to the exact number. And I think that sometimes when I'm on the stand and I say that exact number, you have a jury go, oh, like, okay, that's a number. And even if that number is 150, which feels low in the grand scheme of things, that's still a lot of kids that you've talked to. So I would say your CV, your training log, and then that testifying log every single time you testify. I always make my testifying log. I have like a private version and then I have a public version because I like to take notes for myself, because you will find, especially if you stay in one county, you will testify with similar prosecutors, with similar defense attorneys, and just reminding yourself of what happened in that trial. I mean, there's been notes I've written where I said, you know, I will never forget. There was a defense attorney who asked me on the stand once about sensory details. And he had asked me what was a sufficient amount of sensory details in a forensic interview. And I was like, that's a weird question. And I couldn't figure out how to succinctly answer that. And so I do what I do best. And I'm just like rambling about like that. I don't know what that seems weird. Blah, blah, blah. This is what the kid told me. And really in the back of my brain, what I wanted to say is there is no number. But I couldn't get there on the stand. And so you can guarantee as soon as I got off the stand, I was steady quick writing that down and saying for next time, if I'm ever asked this type of question again, because defense attorneys, they talk to each other. They strategize with one another, just like interviewers do, just like any other profession does. They're going to feed off of one another and talk about what's best and what they've experienced. And so I want to know those things too. That's so off topic.
That's really good. I think that's a great example. Cause like, right. And you kind of pointed out this earlier, just as a quick side note, right. You can go through and get all the trainings and like, you can do a lot of knowledge consumption. And, but at the same time, and this applies again, generally to a lot of things in life, but at the same time, there's a difference between having the knowledge and applying the knowledge, or like being in the context of actually having to apply the knowledge. So I think that's a great example. And anytime for anyone listening, I think, you know, those types of examples are really helpful. It's just like, here was a true example of why documentation was so important and how I actually came out of something with sort of this call to action, go figure out this thing for the next thing, kind of that continual growth as well. Yeah. So I think that's great.
And I know that with the experience of doing actual trials and just getting that experience under your belt really helps with that process of next time I'll know what to say. But how have mock trials kind of influenced that experience with your past practice?
Yeah, like anything in forensic interviewing, like every interviewer knows a mock forensic interview is just an unnecessary evil, or I guess I should say unnecessary. I said that, see, that was like Freudian slip because I hate a mock interview so much, but they are necessary. But I would say with mock trials, it's the same concept. We actually did one at my old center. We just had a ton of interviewers who were saying it would be really nice if we could all get together and just kind of practice some things. We had a handful of newer interviewers. We had a handful of newer district attorneys, and we're consistently being asked the same questions or having to discuss the same kind of material. And so we just wanted to all sort of be on the same page about what that could look like. And so we all got together. We went to the courthouse one day. They'd reserved a courtroom for us. And every single one of us got up in the actual courtroom on the stand. The rest of us served as a jury. People sat, I mean, everyone was organized as it would be. And not just forensic interviewers did practice, but our therapists practice, our medical staff practice, just because it just helped everyone within our multidisciplinary team to see how everyone else would even testify. Because oftentimes in your center, you're so busy in your day to day that I can't take away from being at the center and being available for interviews to go watch my other colleagues testify. In a perfect world, we could, and sometimes we were able to, but it would just be, it's so nice to be able to watch someone else testify and think of how they would answer something. So we would do mock trials. We would also have those discussions as a team. So anytime anybody testified, they would come back and we would have like a little meeting and say, tell us everything. Tell us everything about your time on the stand. Because sometimes you kind of black out. Like you could not for the life of you recount what was asked of you because you're just so nervous or because you were on the stand for an ungodly amount of time. You know, I was the longest I've ever testified on the stand. I was on the stand for 5 hours. There were breaks, but I literally was on the stand for 5 hours. And it was the first time I ever testified in criminal court. So it was real baptism by fire. And it was exhausting and miserable. And I am confident that I did a terrible job because I didn't know better. And so being able to constantly ask your team or your peer review group, we would have our peer review groups. We would, you know, meet quarterly and we would have a topic like, you know, interviewing high-risk youth or interviewing littles. Like we would always have kind of a base topic. And one time we just did a topic of testifying and everyone came to the table and just said, here's what I've had a defense attorney ask me. When I had the DA ask me this, this is kind of how I explained this. And it was so helpful. You can read a ton and research. You can go to trainings. But that real life experience, there's nothing like it. And just to feed off people who've already done it, I cannot recommend it enough.
And it sounds like earlier when we were talking, we said like, what are those three things? I think you went through three things in documentation, which was awesome. It sounds like this process of actually applying and doing mocks, maybe as another one, would that be true?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, practical application. I mean, there's nothing that compares to it.
So going back to what you mentioned previously about having really prepared, succinct ways of explaining things on the stand, what are some of those terms or topics that you think should have those succinct answers for?
Yeah, the things that I was missing the most, the things that I made my very first flashcards about was obviously, like I mentioned already, forensic interviewer. And then inevitably, as an expert, you'll be asked to explain the process of disclosure. There's a really good article that I've linked in my presentation that help just give a really good, it's an old article. I want to say it's from like the 90s or the early 2000s, but it still applies. Like everything about it is still in best practice today. But so having an understanding of process of disclosure and a good way to link it to something that juries can grab onto, which I have always said is like the grief process. You can liken the two together because most people understand that there's a process to grieving and they've even heard of like there's denial and there's anger and there's acceptance. It's the same thing when it comes to process of disclosure. And so having those analogies to talk about, I think also being able to succinctly explain what is sensory detail. What does that mean? What does that look like? And one of the things that I say on the stand routinely, and it's still true to this day, is you can always liken a sensory detail to like scuba diving is what I say, because I've never in my life been scuba diving. And so someone who has been scuba diving should be able to say what it feels like to put the air tank on their back, what it feels like when they first go underwater, things that they've seen, things that they learned beforehand. All of those, what they could feel, what they could taste, what they could see, what they could smell, all of those things are an indication that that was an experienced event, right? So I can't say those sensory details about scuba diving because I've never done it. I could guess, maybe, but I wouldn't be able to clearly define that for you. It's just like in sexual abuse. A child is able to give you those sensory details. It's just another indication. It was an experienced event and not something they read or not something they were coached to say or not something they were exposed to on TV. Those are two very different things. So that one, and you're asked about a lot. And as a forensic interviewer, because you're objective, because you're neutral, because you don't have a stake in the investigation, you truly don't, then you can't say on the stand if you believe the child or not. That's not your role. You know, I can tell you what they shared with me. I can tell you some of the things that helped me understand that this was an experienced event, but I could never say that kid was telling the truth. I could never say that that kid was lying. I couldn't even give a percentage of if this kid's information was factual or not. So that just helps kind of reinforce why you do what you do in an interview. And, you know, it's for the jury to decide if this event happened or not, if the kid is telling the truth or not. So sensory details, same thing with periphery details. Periphery details are those things that happen around the abuse. So where you were when it happened, who was there, what was going on. It's all those WH type questions that you get when you're doing a forensic interview. So being able to explain what a periphery detail is, because just hearing that at the surface, people are like, I don't know what that means. And I saw it in you too, because as soon as I said it and I said WH, you both said, oh yeah, like the big, it was a big nodding of the head.
That makes sense now.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're educated, you understand the term periphery, but when you're like in the context of a forensic, you're like, oh, I got it. Also, you know, it kind of gets attached with the process of disclosure, but there are factors that influence someone outcrying to abuse or not. And people don't think about them. They want to say, oh, it was their dad. Of course they would tell. Why would they, you know, why would they want to still be around that person? Why would they have waited so long to disclose? Like, those are things, for better or for worse, people think about. And so you have to explain, like, here's some of the factors that influence a kid waiting to tell. People think if something bad happens, the kid's going to scream and yell and go get help right away. And that is not the majority of the case. It's just not. And people have a hard time understanding that. So explaining some of those factors, knowing that list of here's some very like bullet point things you can explain to a jury about here are factors that are influencing this kid's outcry. And then being able to even succinctly explain grooming. It's my least favorite. I probably have 4 flashcards about grooming because it is so involved and it is really, really difficult to explain. I feel like it doesn't sound like it is, but it is. And there's just so many subtle ways to groom a child versus the overt ways that people think of when they think of grooming. But those subtle ways are just as powerful and just as meaningful and have just as big of an impact on a kid. So grooming for sure. And then I think the last one would be explaining episodic memory versus your script memory. And that's really in the weeds about interviewing, but kids tell, everybody tells stories in a certain way. And if you've experienced an event every other day or over a chronic amount of time, the way you tell about the abuse is going to be different than if it happened one time or even 3 separate times. You use a different tense of wording. You speak in generalities, you tell it different. And so I've always said that's the best one to give an analogy for with juries. Cause I talk about, like, if you have a favorite restaurant that you go to for occasions, or it's your Friday night hangout, you can probably say like what it is you typically choose to eat off the menu. Maybe you sit in a certain area of the restaurant, or maybe you have a same server or your favorite cocktail that you have. So you can talk about going to that favorite restaurant on Friday nights, but the way you tell those stories may be different than that one time you went to your favorite restaurant on a Friday night. And on that occasion, the waiter dropped a tray and spilled food in your lap. So that time may stick out to you more so when you went 3 Fridays ago. So you're going to tell that those incidents differently. It's the same thing with chronic abuse. I may not be able to tell you from beginning, middle, and end what happened 3 Fridays ago when my dad came in my room, but I can tell you about this one time when my dad came in my room and this different thing happened. And so that's why I'm talking about this one. So that's really in the weeds of interviewing and testifying, but those are the big topics. I feel like I'm sure I'm missing some. Those are the ones that I feel like I've experienced on the stand that just the ones I cared about the most. And so those are the ones I made flashcards about.
I think the way that you liken those topics to really relatable scenarios is extremely helpful. So thank you for that explanation.
You're so
welcome. I've never been scuba diving either. So now I'm feeling the need. I'm like, I don't know.
That doesn't sound like the greatest activity for me. Maybe a little claustrophobic or something. I don't know.
Fair.
Cool, awesome. But I don't know.
So. Awesome. All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us on this, Megan. We really appreciate just you sharing your experience, your passion. It's very clear in how you go about your day to day and how you engage with people that you're extremely passionate about this type of this work, this space. So thank you for that. And anything else that you want to share with the audience? I was almost thinking with the amount of experience you had, we talked about this earlier a little bit of where you're like, you know, sort of your past self or like the new forensic interviewer. Are there any parting words? Like imagine talking to a new forensic interviewer. You've shared a lot of knowledge today about how to prepare for court, but is there anything else that you would just offer as a word of encouragement to a new forensic interviewer, maybe your past self? Would you want to share that at all?
Yeah, sure. I think just give yourself some grace. Your job is really, really important and it's stressful. Your ability to do your job effectively has a lot of weight on people's lives. And that's not even dramatic. That's not exaggerating. That's just truth. And so what I would say is whether you've been interviewing for a month or whether you've been interviewing for 20 years, you can always learn something new. Don't ever think you've got this. I'm the best. You're never going to have a perfect interview ever, ever, ever. You can always walk out of a room and think I should have asked this or I could have asked this better. So I would say give yourself a little bit of grace. Always, always, always be learning and educating yourself and talk to your peers and learn from your peers' mistakes and positive outcomes. And because I miss the room and all things interviewing so much, if you ever want to talk interviewing or testifying, I will entertain that idea.
Awesome. Awesome. Thanks again, Megan. We really appreciate you.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks so much for listening to the Real Evidence Podcast. You can find us on all podcast platforms. Please consider subscribing. You can also rate the podcast and share with your friends. We really appreciate you taking the time to listen. You can always check out the podcast page as well at www.gardify.com/real-evidence-podcast. That's a mouthful. And if you're interested in Gardify as a solution, or if you're just curious more about what we do, you can also reach out to us through our website, or you can email sales@gardify.com. Thanks again.